The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future, with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Looking now into two differing views of American writing and its connections with colonial and revolutionary America. We'll begin with Dr. Richard Beale Davis, who for many years served as Alumni Distinguished Service Professor of American Literature at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Dr. Davis specializes in early American writing and intellectual history, and he's the author of a three-volume series on intellectual life in the colonial South, which was published in 1978 and which won a National Book Award. Dr. Davis has written extensively on the early years of American politics and literature about figures such as Jefferson, William Byrd, Washington Irving, James Fenimore Cooper, and Edgar Allan Poe. He's held fellowships with the Guggenheim Foundation, the American Council of Learned Societies, the Fulbright Lecturer Program, the Folger and Huntington Libraries, and he's worked at Colonial Williamsburg. Dr. Davis, it's a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center, and welcome to Soundings. Tell me, how did you come to a career in early American literature?
I grew up in the Tidewater, Virginia historic area and saw all around me every town I lived in had a church with a cannonball in it from the Revolution or something of that kind. And most of them had been burned. My grandmother used to take me as a boy to Williamsburg, stopped by there long before the Restoration. I've seen it through all of its stages, to see her old friends who were living up and down Duke of Gloucester Street, and to visit her brother's grave, which was in Bruton Parish Church. I was born into a family which was much interested in Southern history, especially, and in the roots of America, because some of us had gone back to the 1620s in Virginia. And my father still had the name of his ancestor who came over in 1622 from Bermuda, England via Bermuda.
Tell me about your work here at the National Humanities Center, Dr. Davis.
Well, I'm working on the Revolutionary Period, and by the Revolutionary Period I mean from about 1763, which is a conventional date for beginning the uproar. There's no such thing as one date for beginning the excitement and various kinds of movement which led to the Revolution, and carrying it not only through the Declaration of Independence and the Treaty of Ghent for peace, but carrying it to the adoption of the Constitution, that is, through the Articles of Confederation down to the adoption of what was to be our permanent form of government. My point of view is still literary. I am trying to present it through what people actually wrote and said. The analysis has, for the moment, to be at a minimum, as it was in the three volumes I've recently done on the colonial period. There is analysis there, there is criticism there, but I felt that my project was to present the evidence, or at least to suggest where the evidence was. I could not present it all. And one of the reasons I wanted to come over here was because this was a very center what was the very center, I felt, of Southeastern evidence among your universities and state institutions and so on, right here in North Carolina, and then within a 150-mile radius of us, almost everything, is an enormous percentage of the evidence that exists in this country on what Americans of this period, Southerners particularly, thought. I think the Southerner must be reconsidered. He has been reconsidered, as Morgan's book, The Dilemma of Colonial Virginia, Freedom versus Slavery, which is concerned somewhat with this sort of thing. But he is analyzing as a historian, while I'm trying to see what these men said, how they said it, what their backgrounds were. Are they like New England's? Very much more like them than I think Perry Miller and others have admitted. They both sections drew their ideas from the Whig elements in Britain in their time and in the late 17th century, just before their time. But there are certain twists which are peculiarly, or if not peculiarly, at least largely Southern.
Professor Davis, as you examine literature in the early American Republic, what are you looking for?
I'm trying to see what is the kind of thing which produced a Jefferson, a John Marshall, a James Madison, all of whom come into prominence in this, George Mason and his Bill of Rights, William Henry Drayton of South Carolina, Iredell of North Carolina, all of these people who served on the Supreme Court later, began by expressing themselves in newspapers, usually both in newspapers and in separate pamphlets, and in the legislative records. And the legislative records, which North Carolina, I'm glad to see, is redoing, because they're finding so many more than were published earlier. Those things need to be looked at, shown to exist. Many people don't even know they exist. Some of the best rhetoric of the Revolutionary period was spoken in the last years of the Houses of Burgesses of Virginia and North Carolina and Maryland and South Carolina, or the House of Commons, as it was called in South Carolina. I don't remember what North Carolina called it now. And in the first state legislatures, some excellent oratory and some excellent rhetoric. It's worth studying from a point of view simply of its rhetoric. And I expect to approach that to some extent. And then the clergy. It's often been said that New England clergy fomented the revolution. I find that Southern clergy, who allegedly were loyalists, were probably not more than 5% loyalist. Even the Presbyterian and Episcopal clergy, who were likely to be loyalists, if anyone were, the Baptists were not going to be. The Lutherans had severed their relations, or simply had not brought any relations with the mother country with them to a considerable extent. But the clergy in the South were writing some of the best pamphlets and publishing some of the best propagandistic and philosophical sermons. One difference between the South and the North, all the way through the sermon literature, which is something that interests me particularly, too, is that the Southerner never, and this is a generality, the Southerner never was, whether he was a Baptist or a Presbyterian Calvinist or an Anglican, never was as interested in theological dogma as the New Englander was. During the Great Awakening, which in a sense was a preparation for the Revolution, I'm still running across in the histories of people who ought to know better, those that are coming out right now, that I ran across just within the past week, a statement that the Great Awakening began in New England with Jonathan Edwards, which is really gross ignorance. The Great Awakening began in the Middle Colonies with Dutch Reformed or German elements, and then the Methodist element in Georgia with John Wesley and the great George Whitfield was the next most important one, and then Edwards was a third element.
I wonder, Dr. Davis, if you'd comment on the goals of your literary investigations in early American writing and Southern literature.
If we are to understand our roots, a term which has been a little overdone in our time, but if we are to understand ourselves, we've got to understand our roots, but we will understand ourselves much better if we understand all the regions of this country and the minds of the regions of this country rather than relying on a group. It's the fault of all the other regions that New England is in this dominant position. They were the ones who had the printing presses and who wrote in this period. They advertised themselves and the other regions did not. Now part of that is a result of the fact that the South was predominantly an agricultural region, while the Northeast was certainly agricultural to some extent, but was to also even greater extent mercantile. And that made a great deal of difference. That gave Harvard its great endowment, Yale its endowment, and even influenced Princeton, which is sometimes called a Southern school and Northern, the farthest north Southern university, Princeton is sometimes called. But from what we do have, I would say not until we get to this period I'm working on now, the Revolution, does the Southern mind show itself really as equal to that of the Northern mind, despite the fact I've just done three volumes to prove that the colonial mind of the South was important. I think it was. But I don't think you can put John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and Benjamin Rush and so on ahead of the group of great Southerners, some of whom I've mentioned here, the Marylanders, the Virginians, and the people from the two Carolinas, even the few from Georgia. And actually, you can put those Southerners ahead of them in reasoning power, in expression of that reasoning power. Jefferson and Madison, especially.
A final question, Dr. Davis. To your mind, what are the lessons of American writing?
I would say the obvious thing, I think, that American literature impresses on me our absolute desire, our searching, it's groping sometimes it's frantic reaching out for values, for moral values, for a sense of order. Faulkner, in that magnificent conclusion of The Sound and the Fury, with the sense of order that he's depicting there, I think it's everywhere. In Hawthorne, he says it explicitly in The Scarlet Letter. We violated a sense of the order, moral order. And so it comes to values. Our art is associated with values.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Our discussion of early American writing and its connections to the formative years of the Republican and Democratic experiment continues now with Professor Emory Elliott of Princeton University, one of the scholars in residence at the center. Dr. Elliott specializes in colonial American writing in his research and teaching at Princeton. He's the author of two books on Puritanism and its influence on American literature, and he's written numerous articles and reviews on artists, poets, clergymen, playwrights, and social patterns in 16th, 17th, and 18th century America. Dr. Elliott has held grants and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Princeton University Humanities Council, the American Council of Learned Societies, and the Woodrow Wilson Dissertation Fellowship Foundation. Dr. Elliott served as a captain in the United States Army. Dr. Elliott, welcome to Soundings. Currently, you're writing about the period between the ending of the American Revolutionary War and the early years of the 19th century. Tell me about your work.
And I'm attracted to that period because it seems to me the time when so many things that characterize American culture, and the American political system, social organization, come into being, that it's a crucial turning point era. What particularly interests me are the effects upon the clergy and the writers that the changes in the society and in the political organization have during this period. Specifically, if I can be a little more concrete about this, throughout the 17th and 18th century, people lived with a certain set of assumptions about the service that religion rendered to the society, the place of the clergyman in the society, his authority as a leader, not only religious, but a moral and social leader as well. And there were also a set of assumptions about the role of literature, poetry, and people who wrote poetry in the society. And as we entered the American Revolution, these traditions, which had existed back into the 16th and 17th century, still persisted. And what strikes me as so significant is that the revolution itself brings about significant changes, in fact, a revolution of mind, to use John Adams's own phrase, which has tremendous impact upon the way people think about religion, the clergyman, and the writer and literature in the society. In fact, all the arts, but I, in this book, I'm not going into the other arts. And that we're still living with those changes today, that the problems that those individuals face, those writers and clergymen, are problems that have persisted throughout the 19th and 20th century. Thus, what I'm prepared to argue in this book is that you can see a kind of genetic code for American literature and American social organization right there in that 15 to 20 year period that occurs just after the American Revolution. And what fascinates me is the way that these individual writers and intellectuals try to respond to this, because suddenly their whole world has changed. And you can see them first resisting the change, arguing against it in their writings, and ministers in their sermons, trying to exercise political power to prevent these changes from occurring because they become threatening to the authority and the leadership of these intellectual men, mostly men. In this time. And that is giving shape to the ways in which they then respond to the society, the kinds of things that they write, the themes of their work, even the structures of their sermons and of the literary works that they produce. And what I'm suggesting is that when you look at later writers, they're responding to the same kinds of patterns. Yeah. To me, looking back, it's not fragmentation so much as an entire reordering, that there is a new order coming forth, and the difficulty for people living through such a change is to see this change as a reordering and not as a fragmentation. So their perception was confused, as one would expect. Now, traditional arguments about this issue, and you're right, of course, we all know that the revolution brought about major political and social changes, but the traditional arguments are that it isn't until Emerson and the writers of the 1830s that intellectuals really began to perceive a change in their status, a change in the role of the writer in the society. And I'm suggesting that they saw these changes taking place quite early, and that the writers who now are mostly forgotten, who preceded Emerson, were desperately struggling to overcome the difficulties that they faced and find new ways of speaking to what they perceived as a new kind of audience.
Who are some of these writers?
Names famous to me, but not famous to the public at large, I think, even today. People like Philip Freneau, Hugh Henry Breckinridge, novelist in Pittsburgh, Charles Brockden Brown, Philadelphia novelist, Timothy Dwight, Joel Barlow, Dunlap, William Dunlap, playwright, and other more minor figures. Those are the major writers of the period.
Professor Elliott, what kinds of influences or effects did these changes you've been describing have on these 18th century Americans and their literature?
What I'm suggesting here is something that feminist historians have begun to help us understand, and that is by studying the changing role of women in American society throughout our history, from the landing of the Puritans on down. They have begun to see the period after the Revolution as a crucial time for the status of women in the society. There's an important book by a woman scholar at Yale, Nancy Cott, called The Bonds of Womanhood. And what she perceives is that women after the Revolution are being perceived by men as inhabiting a separate sphere of social life and being in charge of a domain, a domestic domain, that is really quite apart from the practical affairs of business and government, the affairs of the important political affairs of the society.
Well, what was it like before this relegation to this domestic domain?
Now, that's an issue that hasn't been clearly understood, I think. In my own study, and I worked on this problem in an earlier book on the Puritans and in a couple of essays, what I'm seeing is quite a different relationship between men and women in America before the Revolution, not one that necessarily puts women in a more superior position. They certainly were in a subordinate position to the men in their lives. And within the family, all of the manuals on family life emphasize the wife's submission to the husband. And this was part of a whole hierarchy that went all the way to God. However, in 1750 or in 1720, a woman's intellectual contribution to the society, if a woman were a writer or if she engaged in discussion with her husband about important ideas and affairs, social affairs, seems to me to be much more respected by the members of the male members of the society than it is in 1800. And what I'm suggesting is that when hierarchy is destroyed, with the Revolution, that there's a reordering of society, not on a vertical grounds, going from God to king to parliament to citizen, but now on a horizontal plane in which it's first seen as being total social anarchy. Everyone proclaims this leveling is going to lead to chaos because everyone feels themselves on the same footing. Well, in response to that, what happened, I think, is a kind of reversion to the basic primitive categories. One thing that was clear is that men and women were certainly not on the same footing, it was perceived. And this is over the cries of Abigail Adams, who protested in her letters to John Adams that they not forget the women in the Constitution, that their equality should be furthered by this revolution. But in fact, I think that it was not only not furthered, that something was lost for the status of women in this period, as they are pushed into this separate domain, into this realm of domestic Potter-like world that women were to inhabit until the end of the 19th century when they began to rebel against those bonds. I've looked carefully at the funeral sermons and the elegies written about women throughout the 17th century and the first half of the 18th century. And there's virtually, I wouldn't say virtually no difference, but there's very little difference in the ways in which men and women are talked about in those writings and their contribution to society. There's no suggestion that the woman's only contribution is in rearing children or in the home. And the contribution made in the society at large is talked about in those writings about women as much as it is in writings about men.
Well, does this mean that the American Revolution was essentially a masculine proposition?
Well, that's one of the curiosities that I'm concerned about, is there is clearly an emergent emphasis upon masculinity that occurs after the Revolution and persists through the Westward Movement in the 19th century, and that this has, I think, a detrimental effect upon women's position in the society. It pushes them not down, but off in a corner or in another room where their activity is not pertinent to what's important. And what I'm suggesting here is that the same thing happens to the writers and to the clergymen. And in fact, you can begin to see criticism of these men as being effeminate or impractical, as having nothing to contribute to the mainstream of society. And this, I think, is something writers still face today. Joel Barlow is a good example. When he left the United States in 1782, he was a prominent member of the society. He went off to France as an ambassador and as a businessman. And while he was there, he wrote a great poem about America called The Columbiad. When he returned in 1805, he wanted to run for Congress, and a congressman on the floor of the Congress said that it would be ridiculous to put a man who had spent his time writing poetry into an important position of power and influence, because his mind was on other things, and that was clear from this, mm-hmm. this activity. Before the Revolution, this was no problem. A governor could be a poet. An important businessman could write literary work on the side, and this was not seen as a contradiction.
Well, that notion of the Renaissance individual apparently no longer prevails. Why is that? Why didn't that attitude survive the aftermath of the American Revolution?
As I see it, it's a kind of rage for order that exists in a democratic society, a tendency to want to put people in categories or into pigeonholes. And you have your activity. If you're a scientist, you do that. If you're a writer, you do that. If you're a minister, then you speak on Sunday morning, and you speak about God and the Spirit. But if you begin to move out of your category and try to influence things in which you are not a supposed expert, as writers frequently do when they get involved in political action, the first charge that's made is that they have no right.
They're annoyingly slippery.
That's right, yes.
You can't pin them down. I think it was Emerson who said, "Tell me your sect and I'll anticipate your argument." Maybe that's what people get upset about. They say, he's a writer, on guard.
That's right, and it's interesting to use Emerson as an example, because he was trying to make the case that the poet, the poet visionary, is the one who can inhabit all of those categories. Of course, this is what Whitman tried to do, and embrace the whole picture. He's the one person who has that right, and Emerson himself is then put into a category.
This process of compartmentalization and categories that you described, Dr. Elliott, seems to present a rather pale forecast. Are we stuck?
I'm afraid that we are, as long as we maintain our a categorical perception of the society. Now, I think that other pressures are beginning to force us to reevaluate that kind of view. By other pressures, I mean in the business world and in the marketplace. That as scientists and businessmen begin to realize that they can't simply work in isolation, that they have to be in touch with social thinkers, with urban planners, and we're having more interdisciplinary work done at all levels. And I believe, or I hope, that this will also allow for an understanding that spirit and morality and the imagination, the sorts of things that writers have to tell us about, that's just as much a part of ourselves as our economic perceptions and our political views, that these things all interact all the time. And maybe we'll begin listening more carefully, reading more of the kind of work that serious writers are trying to give us.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, director of the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. One of the goals of the National Humanities Center is to circulate programs that help increase our understanding of our country and its origins. So I'd like to invite you to listen this week for a conversation with two outstanding scholars of early American literary and social life. They will talk about the cultural sources of our common heritage. They are Dr. Richard Beale Davis of the University of Tennessee and Dr. Emory Elliott of Princeton University. Join us for a conversation with Professors Davis and Elliott this week on Soundings.